Morning.
Morning, Mrs. Usman.
In preparing for this argument, I couldn't help but notice, being the astute legal scholar that I am, that people in my position making this argument have met with a singular lack of success. In fact, I've contributed to that lack of success on a number of occasions. And the key question becomes one of why is this case different from the cases that went before? And I think that there are a number of reasons, both in terms of the proceedings that that occurred before the actual plea and the plea itself. There's no doubt from the record that Mr. Hebron was extremely resistant to a plea, and clearly his counsel advocated that and went to great measures to try to persuade him to plead. This was a case in which six people were charged with a violent kidnapping and attempted murder, and all five of the co-defendants pled, and some number were assembled against Mr. Hebron with the possibility.
Can I just ask you, on page 22 of your brief, and are you discussing what standard we should be applying? Bottom of 22, top of 23. I need to understand what that argument is, because you don't cite any authority for it, and we have the Griffin case.
Well, the standard in the 2255 actions, as the court is well aware, has pretty much boiled down to a manifest injustice standard in terms of that the acceptance of the plea under the circumstances and the forfeiture of Mr. Hebron's right to trial constitutes a manifest injustice. And that's been pretty much the established post-sentencing standard for review of a claim that the plea was not voluntary or not well made.
And so why is your case different from our present?
Well, I think that the facts separate my case from others. You have an immense amount of pressure put on Mr. Hebron, a tremendous resistance both on his part.
I want to stick with the legal question for a moment. On page 23, I just need to understand your argument. You say that for some reason we ought to apply a slightly different standard in looking
I'm sorry?
You argue that we ought to apply the fair and just standard or some hybrid thereof. And then your next paragraph is that the district court here found prejudice in that your client wanted to go to trial, but he was persuaded for whatever reason to enter this plea. And I'm just trying to understand where you came up with that and what authority you have for it.
Clearly the district court ruled in its on the 2255 motion that Mr. Hebron had a colorable claim. Obviously, in denying the motion, he ruled that Mr. Hebron had not been prejudiced. If I said that and I'm not reading it, then I misspoke. The question about the mixed standard is that obviously in cases in which there's an allegation that a promise was made concerning the ultimate sentence, the damage is really not revealed until the sentence is imposed. I don't think this is a case in which the standard that the court uses is really matters, because I think under any standard.
I understand. You want to get to, you know, the judge's findings and credibility, et cetera. But you did make this argument in your brief.
Well, I think it is a mixed case. This is a case in which, candidly, a defendant who makes this claim, and assuming that he was misinformed, deliberately or negligently, and I don't think that really matters, because I think they both vitiate the idea of an informed waiver. I think that really doesn't become revealed until you get to the sentencing part.
But why do we have to go any further than saying that the judge's credibility determination that a promise was not made was not clearly erroneous?
Well, I'm arguing obviously that it was clearly erroneous based on the facts. I'm arguing that what the judge failed to consider was that he looked at it as a one variable equation, that he had to make a finding that the trial counsel deliberately misinformed his client concerning what would occur. Now, I think that the standard and the review should permit a series of factors, perhaps an undue optimism, that would lead Mr. Hebron to believe that the 7-year sentence was a promise.
Well, let's take promise out of it. Let's say that the aunt and uncle said, well, we thought he'd get 7 years. He thought he'd get 7 years. And the judge said, look, first of all, you signed this plea agreement that you were given no promises. And all of the things the judge pointed out that said this just, it wasn't the type of plea where my hands are tied, the judge's, I mean. And I just don't see where the clear error is.
Well, I think that in past cases, the propriety of the Rule 11 proceeding seems to sanitize all and whatever. And in this case, clearly Mr. Hebron answered yes, no by rote. And one can comment about why someone in that serious a proceeding has no questions whatsoever, but leaving that to the side, there were things in this Rule 11 colloquy that I think departed from what was appropriate. I think in this case, the trial judge gratuitously indicated with regard to sentencing considerations, talking about the guidelines, that gave a clear indication that he was tending to go below the guidelines, that a variance was in the offing, which I think was inappropriate and played into the notion that there was something that Hebron would be getting a sentence that was far lower than the 235 to 295 months.
And he did.
Well, he did, but he didn't get what he believed he was bargaining for. One might say that he shouldn't complain given the equation, but he had the choice to make whether he wanted to give up his constitutional right to trial, whether it was a wise choice or not.
All I meant is that I don't know how you get an irregularity in the Rule 11 proceeding from what the district court said to the defendant.
Well, I think if you look at it from a defendant and a relatively unsophisticated person's perspective, that plays exactly into the notion that something very good is coming.
Didn't the trial judge say, you need to understand, I'm not promising you anything?
That's right. But I think the filter is people want to hear the good report, the good news, the optimistic report. And there really is no place for that in the Rule 11. Why is that? What does that add to the equation? It only seems to add an element of you should plead. This is a good idea because I'm going to give you something better than the guidelines. I'm going to help you out.
Roger said he did get something better than the guidelines.
Well, that's how it turned out. Yeah. But that if you take the trial judge's word, that was unclear.
I mean, your argument seems to be the test here ought to be something like, can we find on this record that a reasonable person in the defendant's circumstances was misled?
Well, I think that's part of it.
But I think, as Judge Henderson said, there isn't anything to support. Well, there are things to support it, but certainly nothing that you can prevail on.
Well, the clear claim in this case was that trial counsel deliberately falsified what would happen. And the trial court made a finding on that, and credibility findings of that nature. But there were certain things that pointed to the notion. There was testimony from family members to the same effect. Hebron testified that way. And there were things that where the 7-year number came up in terms of an admission that there was an attempt to get 11C1C plea for 7 years. Even at the time of sentencing, that was the request of trial counsel. And it requested a variance that was fairly disproportionate to what we typically see. The guidelines were 20 to 25 years. And requesting a 7-year sentence seems to play into the notion that the number 7 had significance in this case. Whether it was a promise or an extremely optimistic projection as to what might happen, I think that's irrelevant because I think that a trial counsel walks a very fine line when he confuses promise. Well, I shouldn't say it that way. I should say there's a tremendous tendency that promise and optimism will be confused. And I think that that may well have been the case here. I think.
But I mean, you're suggesting trial counsel should be foreclosed from saying anything. Say, look, you know, whatever. I don't have any doubt, I'm sure you don't either, that in the conversation with the defendant, you sometimes say, you know, it could be as low as 7, it could be much higher. That's in the hands of the trial judge.
Well,
right?
Obviously, that's art. There's a way of saying.
But I mean, that's kind of the way it can play out, right?
It can play out that way, or
so then if you have the wrong defendant, heard 7 only and walks away and told his cousins and uncles and everybody else, and now they all believe 7, and that's not what the defense counsel said.
Well, the question is whether it's reasonable under the circumstances for the defendant to believe that 7 is what he's getting, and if that's his belief when he walks in to take that plea. He's not making a knowing and voluntary waiver of his right to trial. He's making a waiver with the belief that something is assured or is going to happen.
Well, his personal limitations are affecting the process, but he's making a knowing waiver.
It's the filter that...
I don't know what we can do as an appellate court in this kind of a circumstance. How do you factor in the limitations of the individual when there's nothing on the record to suggest, well, he simply didn't have the brain power to understand that everything he signed was a nullity and everything that he confirmed was not accurate, and the only thing his brain absorbed was 7.
Well, it was also something that was apparently absorbed by the family, which had direct contact with the attorney as well. But I would submit that there were a confluence of factors here in terms of the court's mention of what it would do during the Rule 11 colloquy, as well as his attorney allocuting, in effect, during the Rule 11. I mean, what was the reason for that? I mean, a discussion of his client's merits and his lack of involvement in the offense. All of this, I would submit, amalgamates to create an impression that's obviously false. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Roback.
May it please the court, Harry Roback on behalf of the United States. The trial judge in this case did not clearly err when he found, after an evidentiary hearing, that appellant's plea counsel, Mr. McDaniel, did not promise appellant a 7-year sentence or any sentence for that matter. The district court held an evidentiary hearing in which he heard live testimony from appellant, from appellant's aunt and uncle, and appellant's plea counsel. Based on the live testimony that the district court heard, in which the district judge had the opportunity to assess the credibility of each witness, to look in the witness's eyes, to hear the inflection in their voice, and to explore why they were testifying the way they did, and based on the record that had preceded the evidentiary hearing in the form
of... Does it matter who's looking in their eyes?
Well, I think it's important.
But it's all bogus. I mean, we have to defer to the district court because that's the way the rules of the game are, and it wouldn't make sense for us to do it on a cold record, but looking in the eyes is not the winner.
Well, I think the important point is that the district court had the opportunity to listen to each witness testify live, and so the district judge's review of the record was not limited to black and white pages of a transcript.
Yeah, I understand. And so, that's the process. They get the shot, and unless they do something that's off the wall, we defer to them.
That's right. And in this case, the court should defer to Judge Friedman's factual findings because Judge Friedman was the trial judge in this case throughout. He had the opportunity to not only preside over the evidentiary hearing in which appellant and his plea counsel testified, but also he presided over the Rule 11 colloquy in which Judge Friedman had a direct exchange with appellant. And
if the test is on this record, can the appellate court feel that or conclude that this defendant reasonably misunderstood what was going on? Would the result be different?
No. In this case, we don't think there's basis for concluding that appellant actually misunderstood what possible sentence could be imposed. Judge Friedman went to great lengths during the plea colloquy, to explain to appellant that he faced a sentence that could be anywhere from essentially 0 to life imprisonment. He said, moreover, I think four times, that he could not promise what that sentence could be, and no one could, because no one knew, but that ultimately it would be the district court, Judge Friedman himself, who would impose that sentence. And this also was not the first time that appellant had heard this. At the, I think it was the May 22nd, 2009 status conference, Judge Friedman explained to appellant that he was facing, if convicted of all of the charges, which included far more than just kidnapping, included assault with intent to kill, use of a firearm during an offense, and many other charges, he would face 32 years in prison mandatory. If appellant, though, entered a plea with the government, he would then, that is to say, the district court would have a significant amount of flexibility to impose a sentence far below the 32 years, as well as far below what the guidelines themselves suggested, because they were only advisory. And that's what Judge Friedman ultimately did. Appellant was sentenced to nearly 7 years below the minimum range in the guidelines. And so in this case, we think that a reasonable person, based on all that was said to him, including Judge Friedman crediting appellant's lawyer's testimony that he never promised or said that he would get a 7-year sentence, we don't think a reasonable person in appellant's position would have had any misunderstanding, intentional or otherwise.
So is your answer that under the manifest injustice standard, if this court were to conclude that defendant misunderstood, he still could not prevail?
Well, I think...
In other words, I gather the argument has been abandoned, but in the opening brief, the statement was made that, you know, the district court had found prejudice in that defendant wanted to go to trial, and somehow, you know, there was a game changer here, and the game changer was the promise of 7 years. And that people were sort of looking out for the defendant's best interest, but he wanted to go to trial. So the question would be, can an appellate court, under the manifest injustice standard, if it were to conclude that the defendant, a person in the defendant's position, reasonably misunderstood the proceeding, would that be tantamount to manifest injustice?
Well, I don't think so in this case, and it's because in this case, first of all, in terms of a game changer, we think that would most reasonably be, as the trial court suggested, that the co-defendants pled guilty right before appellant ultimately pled guilty as well. And so the game changer, we don't believe, is, and Judge Friedman did not find, was a 7-year sentence being promised, but rather the fact that the risk of appellant now getting this 32 mandatory years imprisonment went up substantially.
But what about my question?
In terms of, well, I think these cases are going to be fact-specific, and you're going to have to see...
My hypothetical.
Well, your hypothetical, I think it would still depend on what the basis for the misunderstanding was. So, for instance, if a defendant, it turns
I
out...
I thought Judge Edwards, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I thought he was asking you, suppose an appellate court were to conclude on the written record that the a defendant... as a reasonable person, in light of everything that happened, misunderstood what was happening. Would manifest injustice allow us to send it back to the district court for resentencing?
No, I think it would depend. So if, for instance, that there was a reasonable basis for the defendant to misunderstand a non-material part of the guilty plea, we don't think it would. If, though, a defendant, it turns out, for instance, misunderstood their sentencing exposure because there was a language barrier that no one was aware of, so the person actually did not really speak English or speak English well, then that might go to whether or not the guilty plea was entered voluntarily. And I think that's ultimately the test, is whether the plea was entered voluntarily. And in this case, Judge Friedman, we think, correctly found and certainly did not clearly err in finding that the plea entered by appellant was voluntary. And it was knowing. He was informed.
So you're saying you don't want to answer my hypothetical?
Well, I do. It's just that your hypothetical, Your Honor, I think...
It's positive to you as a question of law.
As a matter of law, if a defendant misunderstood a material aspect of the plea in which they were entering. And the court and this court could make that determination based on the record. I think that could result in the case being remanded back to the district court.
It really hurt to say that, didn't it? You looked so pained.
Well, you know, it came out a little smoother than I thought it would, but still. But the point is that in this case, Your Honor, there is no basis for finding that a reasonable person in appellant's position would have misunderstood. Because, as Judge Friedman himself found, he had told the appellant several times he didn't know what the sentence would be, and he couldn't know, and no one could know. And so the appellant understood, and certainly a reasonable person in the appellant's position would understand, that the exposure he was facing as a result of entering this guilty plea was up to life imprisonment. And just note that appellant, of course, did not receive that. He did not receive the 32 years. He did not even receive 20 years. He
what
received.
What did he plead to again? I can't remember. What did he plead to?
He pled to one count of kidnapping. And the government, as a result of him entering that plea, dismissed, I think it was 8 other charges, including assault with intent to kill. So the only other thing I would add is just that appellant's counsel at oral argument mentioned that there was some defect in the Rule 11 colloquy, and that was not an argument raised either below or in appellant's briefs. Judge Friedman had an extensive Rule 11 colloquy in which he made sure that appellant understood what he was pleading guilty to and what the consequences or ramifications of entering that plea would be. The court has no further questions.
Right.
We would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. Does Mr. Sussman have any time? Would you like a minute?
Just quickly, I wanted to just respond to Judge Rogers' comment. And I with regard to my statement about prejudice being found, I said it inartfully. Clearly, prejudice wasn't found, but I think what I meant to say was that Judge Friedman had said that if it can be demonstrated that that Mr. Hebron was induced to plead by virtue of a misrepresentation, that would establish prejudice as a per se matter. And I'm sorry that if I confused the court unnecessarily. With regard to the general question about confusion, I think that is a viable basis. This plea agreement is a contract. And if you're going to talk about a contractual arrangement and one of the parties comes there with a total misunderstanding of probably the primary thing in the contract from his perspective, I think that there has not been the kind of meeting of the minds and negates the kind of voluntariness that would be necessary to enter this kind of arrangement. Thank you.
Well, that's one reason, you know, the Rule 11 sounds like a litany, I know, but that's really the only way to test if someone's confused or someone is unsure. And in this case, the judge didn't feel that way. And
I understand that, but I think that the notion that the Rule 11 colloquy is something in itself and nothing outside matters is obviously. There are situations, if someone's family was being held hostage and there was a question about coercion and someone said nobody's threatened me or to induce, clearly the court would be revisiting that situation. So the notion that the propriety of the Rule 11 trumps anything that might happen is, I think, illusory and not correct.
All right. You were appointed to represent the defendant, Mr. Sussman. We thank you for your usual able assistance.
Thank you, ma'am.